found ourselves at the last segment of Eliyahu. This is the sixth shir in our series of Eliyahu Navi. We're now finishing up with the Perek Yud Test, the 19th chapter in Sefer Melachim. And this is going to be the last time we're focusing specifically on the series of Eliyahu Navi, but don't worry, he will be back many times in Jewish history too, as well as many other times, incidentally, we'll see in the coming stories. So let's take a moment to appreciate where we are, why it's significant to appreciate tonight. Tonight's a rather sombering learning. So we've just come out of Har Carmel. The Carmel experience, Eliyahu has unequivocally demonstrated HaKadosh Baruch Hu's power over the world. I mean, this is probably the best you can ever get. And so you expect the next morning, everybody's waking up, you know, waving their I Believe in Hashem flags. They got their I Believe in Hashem lawn signs out. You know, you can imagine there's been a societal transformation. And yet that's not the picture we get in our Perek as well. I'd like to just add an interesting thing that occurred this Shabbos, that just as a footnote to last time, looking at Har Carmel, the Gemara actually points out, and I didn't get a chance to include this last time because I hadn't learned it until this last Shabbos, the Gemara in Bracha says that when Eliyahu pleads to Hashem in Har Carmel, he says, Aneni Hashem, Aneni, Hashem, answer me, answer me. The Gemara in Bracha Zavtes says, wait a second, why is he asking Hashem twice to be answered? So the Gemara explains, once is the fire should come down from heaven, and twice is that people should not think it's sorcery. So why do you need both of those? So Rav Kook points out in his commentary on the Gemara in Brachos, we learn every Shabbos afternoon, half an hour before Mincha, his Pirush, his expansion on the Agadot in the Gemara. So he says a very interesting thing in Ein Ayah, that ultimately, whenever a person has to make a decision, there are times when HaKadosh Baruch will leave it up to us to make that decision. Sometimes he'll make it a little more obvious, there's less decision making necessary. The more obvious, the more overt, the more miraculous something is, the less we have to exercise our intellect. But the less we exercise our intellect, then actually the less our heart is influenced. Because let's say in a situation where there's an incontrovertible miracle, in that situation, then it's kind of like logically I'm forced to accept the situation. Emotionally, I'm not there. It was too fast for me to absorb that. So in fact, Rav Kook argues, Eliyahu was asking for a miracle which had a degree of debate. He was asking, Aneni Hashem, let there be fire from heaven, but let it be something where there is an alternative, where people could still explain it away, so that where they have to make a decision to say that they believe in Hashem. So sometimes we think of Eliyahu at Har Carmel as this incontrovertible miracle. The way that Rav Kook looks at it is based on this Gemara, is that he wanted it to have some degree of decision-making, because that's more of a real decision when Israel makes it. Just a fascinating perspective as to what was being achieved. Which leads us to, did it work? That's a very important question. And what's interesting about this is that Tanakh does not answer that question explicitly. We're left very quiet about this. We know the reaction of one person, but we don't hear about the reaction of Klal Yisrael, the nation of Israel as a whole. And that's where we start with tonight. So let's start learning together. We're going to focus on the entire Perek Yud Tes and try to put some patterns in place which really are, I would say, breathtaking. Nothing short of breathtaking in terms of understanding this. Let's start at the beginning here. We're going to look at the first four psukim. So now Eliyahu is waiting for the response. What are the local newspapers going to say? What is society going to be saying? And here's what he's told. We're told the following. Vayaged Achav li'Izebel, eis kol asher asa Eliyahu, ve'eis kol asher harag, eis asher harag, eis kol hanavi'im becharev. So he comes home and he says, honey, do you hear what happened today? You know, Eliyahu got rid of everybody, slaughtered them all. It was a showdown of incomparable. Vatishlach Izebel l'malach el Eliyahu le'mor, ko ya'asun elekim ko ya'asifun, ki ka'es machor asim es nafshecha kenefesh achas mehem. So she sends a very simple kind of message to Eliyahu, and she says, tomorrow be prepared to die because I'm going to kill you like I killed them. Okay, that seems pretty direct. She's not being very euphemistic right now. Vayara vayakom vayelech el nafsho, so he flees. Vayavo be'er sheva asher la'iliyuda vayanach es na'aro sham. So he now goes into Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is the southmost territory of Yehuda at this point in time, or the southern reaches of Yehuda, because now he's in the territory of the south, so he feels he's more protected there. And maybe he's a Navi to the north. Har Carmel is by Haifa, so this is a very far fleeing. V'hu alach b'midbar derech yom. So he goes a day into the desert. Remember, Be'er Sheva is on the edge of the desert, still is today. He sits under what they call here a translation, a broom tree. And he asks to die. Rav ato Hashem kach nafshi ki lo tov anachim avosai. I'm no better than my forefathers. Please take me now. By the way, just we're not going to explore it right now, but we did take a look at this a little while back, where we saw that there was certain fascinating comparisons between Eliyahu Navi and Yonah. Ben Amittai was Ben Amittai because he was the child that Eliyahu saved. Very fascinating. And the idea of Ben Amittai, Ben, the person who expressed MS. You should remember that Yonah had a similar kind of problem where he also ran away from society and sort of found his way out and had this kikayon on the whole business. Very fascinating discussion in and of itself. Okay, so this is what we have in terms of the psukim. So there's a few curious aspects about this. You know, it's hard to understand these zevel just on the face of it. Like, you know, what was going through her mind exactly? You know, did she not understand? Did Achav not explain exactly what happened as the fire descended from heaven? Like, what's happening? Why is she making this death threat on Eliyahu? And he seems to take it very seriously. Also, like, if she really is serious about getting rid of Eliyahu, so let's say she sees him as a threat, which is pretty clear, so then just, like, you know, wipe him out now, snub him out right now. Why wait a day if you're so serious about this? Just doesn't really sit well. So the Mefarshim struggle with this, and I would like to come back to all of these questions at the end when we do a larger wrap-up. But just on a more basic level, the Barbara Nell says the following. So she says like this. This is her logic. You know, you're arguing. Your argument is that there's a monotheistic God who's in control of all other forces in the world, including Baal and all the rain and fertility and so on. Okay. Well, you know, in truth, in pagan religions, this is the way she says is the following. Ki derech ha'elohus la'asos la'avdeyem al kedushas shmam. There, you know, even in pagan worship, there's the notion of there being the deity killing their worshippers, killing their prophets, their seers. So you know what? Yes, there was this destruction of the Nevi'ei Baal, but that doesn't diminish Baal. That just means to say that Baal is like one of those gods who sometimes, you know, gets rid of his worshippers. So you know what? I'm going to demonstrate this by the fact that I'll get rid of you tomorrow and it will equal the playing field. Don't think that killing a prophet it has any indication on the deity itself. That's the argument she's making. And by the way, just to appreciate this in fuller perspective, what that means to say is ultimately, paganism can live with multiple powers. Meaning, you have this God, you're talking about Eliyahu, you know, you talk about Hashem, Elohim, right? I'm all happy with that. But, you know, he can join the pantheon, right? Join the group. Everybody gets along together here, you know. Whereas Eliyahu is trying to prove that there is only one power, right? So she's saying, no, it's all the same. All the prophets, everybody's, you know, everybody gets their chance to get killed by their deity from time to time, and I'll give it your chance tomorrow. So what she's trying to do is she's trying to diminish it, right? So Eliyahu thought that this was the greatest demonstration of godliness. Well, not necessarily. Ezevel is not quite wholly convinced by this as well. That's what that Barbanel says, and that's why she does. Now, you know, it's interesting. Why does she wait for tomorrow? This is a very powerful question. It sounds a little bit like, just to give another Tanakh reference, it sounds like when Moshe Rabbeinu approaches Paro after the prayer goes Svardera, and it's, I mean, you can imagine the whole land is probably erupting in noise, the economy is disturbed, everything's falling apart. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, you know what, if you let us go, we'll pray for you to get rid of the frogs. Tell us when. So Paro says, tomorrow. Like, again, there's this notion of sort of this, almost like this testing, right? That we can do things at our own rate. We can handle another day of frogs. We can kill you tomorrow, says Ezevel. Why is she doing this? So some of the Farshim, there is a very, very fascinating spiritual idea behind it, but just on the more basic level, the Chidak quotes an interesting pirush called Be'er Yitzhak Ashkenazi from Germany, who said that this, in fact, was not a messenger of human form. This is a supernatural messenger. It uses the word malach in the pasuk. So she says, Atishlach izevel malach. It means to say that this was actually a spiritual messenger who was carrying the message of the intent of Ezevel. So it wasn't Ezevel sending, you know, by the way, please, you know, come tomorrow to place your head on the block in front of the executioner. What this was a celestial being saying, Eliyahu, she's going to kill you tomorrow, get going. And he runs from this knowing that he's going to get the knock on the door tomorrow because he has inside information. So that's really a different way of reading this rather than it being her saying this. So she's plotting behind closed doors, and Eliyahu HaNavi gets this message, and off he runs. That's the way that the Chida reads it. So a little bit of a different way of reading this. Okay, interesting thing, just as an interesting insight here, is he goes and he sits under the Rotem. Later on in history, Yonah is going to sit under a Kikayon, which grows this other tree. What is a Rotem? So the truth is we can actually see a Rotem. I remember when I was in Israel, when I was in Keren B'Yavne, we went on Tiolim, many Tiolim, and after the Sukkos break, at the end of the Sukkos break, we went on a Tiol down to the Negev, so we were hiking out in Eilat, and they showed us what a Rotem is. This is a picture of it. Some call it the juniper bush, some the broom bush, and what's interesting is it's referenced many, many times in Tanakh. This is something which is very common in Israel. So as an example, Tehillim says, Chitzei giborim shinunim, the sharp are the arrows of the mighty, im gachalei resomim, with the coals of the broom plant. Right? So why is this, why, what does this have to do with anything? So it's interesting, actually, there's a book by John Hutton Balfour called Plants of the Bible, and he talks about the juniper bush as a type of broom, and here's what he says about it. The Hebrew word rotem or rotem has been rendered juniper in our version. It seems to be the same as the Arabic word retem and the retema of the Moors. Those terms are applied to the kind of broom. It is believed that the rotem is the genista monis perma of botanists belonging to the natural pea family and includes this particular type of plant. It is a shrubby plant with white blossoms. It is found in Spain, Portugal, Barbary, Egypt, Syria, and Palestine. That's why the Moors had it, because it's also in that area of Europe. Elijah rested under the shade of the rotem or broom. Lord Lindsay says that during his travels in the valleys of Mount Sinai, the rotem, a species of broom bearing a white flower delicately streaked with purple, afforded him shelter from the sun in advance of the caravan. Dean Stanley also mentions that during a storm in the rain of the desert, he sheltered himself under a rotem bush. It is a large and conspicuous bush in deserts. It is used for making charcoal by the Arabs. Here's the interesting part. The use of the plant as fuel, as referred to in Psalms, sharp arrows of the mighty and the coals of the juniper, and it would appear that its roots were eaten in certain circumstances. For Job says, who cut up mallows by the bushes and the juniper roots for their meat. The Israelites encamped in the desert of Paran in Ritma, the place of the broom. Ritma is also from the Rotem. Now, the reason this is important about the coals, let's come back to that pasuk in Tehillim about coals, the gachalei resamim. See, has an interesting property of the rotem bush, of the juniper, is that its roots are very hardy, in that if one sets them alight, the coals will actually burn for many days. So much so that they've found they can bury the hot coals of the juniper roots and come back days later to find them still embers. Okay, so there's this long-lasting fire which is to be found in the Gachalei Resamim. It's being used over here in Tehillim to describe the effects of Lashon Hara. Chitzei Giborim Shonanim is referring to those who use their mouth to slander others. Gachalei Resamim, the idea is this ember which never really goes out, the damage which is done and never really goes out. One can wonder if that might be some of the important imagery to know the Rotem over here, the embers of Lashon Hara, of, in this case, of Izevel, searching him out on false charges. Izevel is going to create many false charges for people. But here now, Eliyahu has a wanted poster out about him for unfair charges. He finds rest under this rotten. One wonders about the symbolism of this as well. Why does he want to die? Well, it could be, on the one hand, that Eliyahu, of course, is starving to death. He's in the desert after a day's walk. It doesn't look like he packed his lunch, right? He didn't have too much time to search. It could also be that just he's tired of persecution. Remember, for the last few years, so 3 years, he's been running, he's been a refugee, he's been hiding in different places, in the Nahal Kris, and later on up in the north. And you just, at a certain point, he's just, you know, when does it end? When does it end? I think that perhaps it also might be in the back of his mind is, if Izebel's trying to kill him, then he kind of thinks that all his work, his threat to the nation of Israel of drought, his showdown at Har Carmel, all fall flat. Like, what's the point of all of this? It doesn't seem to have any effect. It doesn't have the desired effect. You can feel this deflating feeling as Eliyahu kind of feels that he's lost all his ability to have had an impact that he hoped and wanted to have. That's a very disappointing and sad moment here in Eliyahu's life. Now this takes us to the next point. So now he's lying there. He's helpless. He wants to die. And we're told the following. we're told of Pesukim Hei Teches, Vayishka Vayishan Tachas Rotem Echad, he's lies and he sleeps under this juniper bush. Vinezze Malach Nogea Boy Vayomer Kum Le'uvayom Le'kum Echol. Get up and eat. This is interesting because ultimately the fact that he's being told that he needs to eat means to say he is really given up, really. He is no longer eating. The Malach is now prompting him to do what is necessary to take care of himself. Vayabait, but he doesn't have food. He didn't have the time to go and pack food. Vayabait v'inei rashasov ugas retzafim etzapachas mayim v'yochav v'yesh v'yokom v'yishkav. So he sees that just by his head is this cake or bread baked on the hot stones, right? That's retzafim, and there's a jug, a cruse of water, and he drinks and he eats and he lies down again. Eat more because you have a long way ahead of you. So it's almost as like the angel's taking this parental role. He's looking after Eliyahu. Go, because you have a long way. Where is he going? He gets up, he eats, he drinks. With the strength of that eating, arba'im yom va'arba'im laila, Ad Har Ha'elokim Chorev. So he now goes to the mountain of God at Chorev. This refers to Sinai. So remember, last week we talked about the connection between Har Carmel and Har Sinai. That isn't just figurative. This is actually geographical as well. He moves from Har Carmel, making his way under the guidance of these angels to Har Elokim Har Chorev. Now, what's interesting about this is that this ultimately is we're bordering on the supernatural here, right? Whether he ate along the way, we don't know, but getting all the way to the Sinai Peninsula, starting in Har Carmel in the north, this is a very serious journey that we see that Eliyahu embarking upon, and we see that it's clear that the angel wants him to get there. This seems to be the direction that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to meet him. He really wants to find him in that place. Now, what's interesting about this is this the cake and the water, where did they come from? It kind of gives us a little bit of a throwback to the times when Eliyahu was in the Valley of Kris, where Hashem was sustaining him. There were the ravens bringing him the bread and the meat and the water from the brook. It sounds a little bit like that, but now it's a malach, now it's a direct malach. We have to wonder to ourselves is, if Hashem wants to speak to Eliyahu, could Hashem not just have spoken to him there in the desert of Be'er Sheva? And the answer seems to be no. There seems to be something necessary that has to happen, which happens specifically in the desert of Be'er, or the mountain of Har Chorev. We have to work out what that is. Let's take a look a little further in the Pesukim and then come back to some questions. This is a very strange conversation which ensues. Remember now, he's made it to Har Sinai. Vayovoi Shom El Hama'ora. He enters the cave. By the way, the fact that it's identified as Hama'ora, the cave, seems to indicate that Tanakh assumes that we know which cave it is. It's a specific cave. It's not just any opening. We have to think about what caves near Har Sinai do we know about? Are there other ones? Keep that on the memo for a moment, on the board. Vayolen Shom, he dwells there. V'hinei Dvar Hashem Elov Vayomer Loi Malacha Poi Eliyahu. So Hashem turns to him and speaks to him and says, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? Which obviously is leading him into the conversation because Hashem sent him here. Vayomer Kanoi Kinesi La Hashem Elokei Atzvokois. I was jealous or zealous for God, the power of all hosts. Ki Ozvu Brisecha Bnei Yisrael. Your nation left their covenant. They destroyed your altars. They murdered your prophets. And I was the last remaining hope. I was the last remaining one remain true. And now, because I did the right thing, I am now become spurned and persecuted. So this is Eliyahu. This is, you can imagine the frustration. You can hear the anger. You can hear the upsetness. This is the theodicy that he's accusing HaKadosh Baruch Hu of over here. How's this justice system working? I've done everything right. I've played all my cards like I should have. And now I'm once again a refugee. Very bitter, very painful statement over here. At the same time, a very strong statement. Hashem responds. And this is such a powerful response. Vayomer, tsev amaritza b'har lifnei Hashem. Leave the cave. Go out onto the mountain in front of God. And Hashem presents him with a large gale, which is enough to uproot mountains. And then he says, Hashem is not found in that gale. After that, there was a large earthquake. But God's not found in that earthquake. And afterwards, he witnesses this terrifying fire. then lo va'esh Hashem. Hashem's not found in that fire either. V'achar ha'esh, called Mombal Dakan. After that is a very penetrating, but very small and high-pitched sound, a very small, thin voice. As he's heard this, he wrapped his head in the mantle, in his cloak. Keep in mind the cloak. We're going to come back to that. And he now hears a voice. He knows Hashem is present. And Hashem asks him the same question again. What are you doing here? It's almost as if Hashem has given him an educational lesson and now asks him the question again. Eliyahu, you got the question wrong the first time. What are you doing here? And he has the strangest part of this entire conversation. What did Eliyahu change from his initial response? The answer is nothing. Nothing. He says exactly the same words to the first question as he does to the second question. Isn't that perplexing? What's happening here? What's Eliyahu really doing? What's going on over here in Eliyahu's mind? Why is he repeating this? What was the lesson Hashem was trying to teach him in between? Very hard to understand this. Very, very hard. Let's take a look at some of the Mefarshei Pshat before we get into the bigger picture here, because there is a theme which is weaving itself through every aspect of this parak, which we are going to need to pick up on. We need to pull together all the beads and put them onto that thread. But before we get there, let's just look at some of the Mefarshei Pshat for just a moment. The Radak over here, David Kimchi, suggests an interesting thing. He says, Kanoi Kinesi. This is what Eliyahu really means. Hakinashi Kinesi, that zealotry, which I said, I forced the drought, I brought the showdown, right? I was very strict with them. L'shem Hashem was all for God. V'ragtin v'yabal hamat imes Yisrael ad she'ozvu brischa shekoras im b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. And I slaughtered them because they were leading or misleading the nation of Israel from their covenant with you. That's what he says is the kina. V'drash brischa shebatlu mehem He says they were even undermining their very covenant of Milah. We saw that the Medrash played with why Eliyahu was putting his head between his knees last week. But Birzmei, what he's saying is that they came so low that they so reject any form of truth that I have to leave. So Eliyahu is feeling really rejected, which is the way we read it. Says the Radak, a good question. What's going on in this conversation? Why is Hashem bringing him all the way to Har Chorev to have this conversation with him? The Radak suggests that really what's happening here is this is a demonstration of goodwill, a demonstration of, in fact, of lauding and praising Eliyahu for what he just did. I'm not just going to say, you know, send you a thank you note. I'm going to bring you to the most special place where I reveal the Torah to tell you, Eliyahu, you did the right thing. And he brought him all this over here. So what the Radak says is, don't think this is reprimanding Eliyahu. What's really going on over here is Hashem is rewarding Eliyahu. You know, you may think that society has turned its back on you. You may think that everybody's rejected you. Understand, says Hashem, I respect you. I am proud of what you just did. And therefore, this is the whole direction of what's going on over here is to give Eliyahu the kavod. It's to ratify his actions rather than to reprimand him. It is interesting to note that when you look in the Psukim in the Torah, just after the Har Sinai episode, there are a lot of interesting points that are shared here. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, and this is following the Chet HaEgel, Hashem says, "Hinei anochi kores bris neged kol amcha yisrael nifloes asher lo nivru b'chol haaretz v'chol hagoyim v'ra'a ha'masher ata b'kibbutz ma'aseh Hashem ki nora hu es asher na yisrael imach." I'm going to make a new a covenant with them on the second Nuchos. Again, the bris that Eliyahu was talking about. Shemolacha, you should guard es asher anochi mitzavcha yom enini goresh miponecha es amori v'zaknani v'chachiti v'imachprizi v'achivi v'ayvusi. I'm going to send out all the nations from in front of you, says Hashem. Hishamer lacha. Please be very careful, he says. Pentich Rosbris, Liyosheva Oretz. Don't make any covenants with the surrounding nations around you, Asherateh Boalecha, that you are entering. Peni Yele Mokesh Bekerbecha, lest they be a snare for you. Kes Mizbochoy Som Titotzun, you should break their altars. Ves Matzevo Som Teshabirun, and you should smash their standing rocks. Ves Asherov Tichrosun, cut down their pagan trees. Don't bow down to any pagan gods. Hashem is a jealous God. Kel Kanohu. He's going to be zealous of your actions. Pentikros Brisli Yosheva Oretz. Lest you make a covenant with those who settle the land. And you're going to stray after their gods. And you'll bring sacrifices to them. And then they'll call to you and you'll eat of their sacrifices. And you're going to intermarry v'zonu b'nosov acharei Elohim, and you will therefore go astray out to their gods v'iznu es b'nocho acharei Elohim. Isn't this amazing? Right after Har Sinai, right after Matan Torah, Hashem says, I'm making a new bris. What's the thing I want you to be careful about? Is don't get too enculturated in the land of Israel because you'll end up serving their gods. And you know what? I'm a very kel kano. I'm a God who's jealous. Isn't this exactly what's happening over here? This is the future. What was said in Parshas Kisisa, which is where this is quoted from, right after the Chet HaEgel, is exactly what Eliyahu is saying. Eliyahu is saying to Hashem, Kanoi Kinesi, I'm representing you, the God who said this at Sinai to the nation of Israel. Don't go after the other nations. Don't enculturate. Don't marry into them. They did this. Their king's married to a Sidonian. Their gods are part of their culture. I was the one representing what you said in the Torah. That's what it seems to be. And the Radak's way of reading this is Hashem is saying to you, you know what? Full circle, I'm bringing you back to Har Sinai where I said this because that's what you did. That's what seems to be said over here. Just to put all the pieces together, this is the statement which Eliyahu took seriously and ultimately led. And finally, we end in the Perek in a very strange way, and then we're going to come back full circle to pull together many of the threads which have not been connected yet. A very strange thing. The next part of the conversation seems like a non sequitur. What happens? We're told the following. Vayomer Hashem Elav, Leich Shuv L'Darkecha Midbaro B'Damesek. So you're supposed to go to the wilderness of Damascus, go all the way up to the north. Uvaso Mashachtes Chazael Melech Al Aram. Go and anoint Chazael to be the new king of Aram. What's Chazael got to do with anything, right? You'll make a new king of Israel in the place of Achav. His name will be Yehu. You'll take Elisha, who will now replace you as a Navi. Whoever will survive the incursion of the north of Damascus will be killed by Yehu, and whoever will be survive Yehu will be killed by Elisha. Meaning this Hashem is changing the God. I'll leave only 7,000 in Israel, all those who did not bow down to Baal and only the mouths that did not kiss him. Wow. So it sounds like the gist of this seems is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is now actually creating a new order. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is replacing everything that went on. And what is interesting over here is that there seems to be three replacements. There's a replacement on the foreign leadership, the internal leadership, and the spiritual leadership are all being replaced. The most interesting of all of these three to me is the replacement of Eliyahu himself. The replacement of somebody could either mean the CEO is now becoming the chairman of the board, right? Or it could mean that he's finding another job, right? Meaning to say, this could be Eliyahu did his job so well, he's now retiring. Or it could be that he perhaps is not the right man for the job in this case. Which one of it is, we have to think about very carefully. What is Hashem really saying to him? Okay, so this is really an important thing to think about in understanding why this is the next logical step in of progression. And finally, let's close the parak with the following fascinating episode as Eliyahu now finds Elisha. This is the last three psukim. Vayelech misham vayimtsa es Elisha ben Shafat v'hu choresh shnei masar tzmadim lefonav. Elisha is coming, he's plowing with 12 yokes of oxen, so many, many oxen are in front of him. V'hu b'shnei masar, and he was at the 12th one behind. Vayavor Elisha elav, vayashlech adar to elav. And he throws his cloak, the same cloak he used to cover his eyes when Hashem was outside of that cave, he throws it on him. He has a sort of a rendition of that. And Vayazov es abakor vayoratzach har Eliyahu, it runs after Eliyahu, he leaves behind his cattle. Vayomer eshkon olo avilu ilimi, please let me go and kiss my father, my mother. Ve'elcha acharecha, I'd like to go after you. Vayomer loy, lech shuv kimeh osisi loch. He says, go back. He says, what did I do for you? Vayoshov me'acharov, vayikach estemer abakor vayizbocheu, uvichle abakor bishlom basar. So he goes and he slaughters the cattle. And he boils their flesh with the instruments that he uses for the farm. And he gives to all the people and they eat. And becomes Eliyahu's servant. He looks after it. Fascinating. I mean, the whole thing is fascinating, this story. You see a lot of the social niceties that Elisha displays are not the general things that Eliyahu himself displays. Meaning, Eliyahu is so esoteric, it's not usually that, you know, he's thinking about who I should say goodbye to first and who I should cook the meal for and include everybody else. That's not the sort of the model that Eliyahu has been displaying up to now. You want us to think about that particular point. We do see a few interesting things. It does sound like Elisha is rich, meaning to say that when you're talking about 12 tzimadim lefonav, 12 yokes of oxen, so we talk about a large amount of cattle, certainly in these days, and so he's probably a rich person, and it sounds like Eliyahu is testing him. It sounds like he's wondering, are you going to come after me, or are you going to stay with your comfortable lifestyle or not? And Elisha seems to be going with him. The number 12, of course, is relevant. It comes back to the number of the 12 tribes of Israel, the responsibility Eliyahu felt for the 12 tribes of Israel when he built that Mizbeach of the 12 stones. It sounds like Eliyahu is trying to find somebody who has that degree of responsibility as well. And Elisha seems to be a little bit torn between where he was coming from and where he's going to. He wants to say goodbye. He wants to pay the right respect, but he also wants to continue with Eliyahu. It sounds like Eliyahu is trying to share with him part of that experience he had at Sinai, that the cloak which was used to shield him, he wants to give to him as well. Very, very, very fascinating. And this ends our perek. Okay, so now, I don't know about you, but I'm thoroughly confused because it just seems that there's many different pieces in this perek which don't seem to follow from one to another. Right? So we have Eliyahu is running away from Izebel. He's now sustained by the Malach. He's taken to Har Sinai. There's a strange conversation in which he repeats himself after Hashem explains that Hashem is not found in these three very terrifying natural phenomena. And then Hashem asks him to replace three leaders, himself included, the king of Israel, the king of Aram, and the prophet of Israel. And then he goes and initiates Elisha. That's this perek. And one has to think about what is going on over here. So what we're going to do is we're going to do two things. Number one is, we look at a parallel for Eliyahu as a person. The next one we're going to look at is a parallel for Elisha, and so for the Har Sinai as well. So the first thing is we're going to look at a parallel between Eliyahu and Pinchas. Okay, so the first thing we're going to look at is, we've looked at this beforehand. We spent a little bit of time in the Abai Barnel already around the first round. However, there's a little more we need to add this time. So the first thing we're going to look at is the parallel between Eliyahu and Pinchas. So a few things which should automatically stand out in front of us is the language of zealotry. When Eliyahu presents himself in front of Hashem, he says, Kanoi kinesi, I was very zealous for you on behalf of you, O God. It's interesting, at the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, when we describe the actions that Pinchas did, it is interesting that when Hashem describes it, it describes how when Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Heshivis Chamosim al B'nei Israel, B'Kanoi es kinesi, when he took my zealotry, when he did what was necessary for me to assume the role of being my defender, says God. A similar thing about his longevity. We know that Pinchas was blessed with Brisi Shalom, my covenant of peace. Many of the Mephoreshim say that Bris of Shalom was against the Malach Hamaves. He had longevity. He was not susceptible to the Malach Hamaves. The Radak in fact says, when Eliyahu says, Ki lo tov adonai me'avosam, not better than my fathers, what is he really saying? He's saying, look, I've lived this long life, says Eliyahu / Pinchas, but have I done well for it? Has it really benefited me? That's his question, meaning the parallel to Pinchas as well. And finally, a very fascinating suggestion, says the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh. The Al-Sheikh HaKadosh is a beautiful essay, an extensive essay on the section, where he describes how Pinchas was able to be invisible. You remember that the two spies that Yeshua sent into Yericho at the very beginning were the spies Pinchas and Kalev, were the two spies sent to Jericho. When it says that Rachav was hiding them, it says she hid him. Why was she not hiding them both? The answer says the Mefarshim, it says the Al-Sheikh quoting over here, Chazal, is that Pinchas was able to become invisible. He was less tied down to physical materiality, and therefore he could become invisible. Why was it, says the Al-Sheikh, HaKadosh, that Izebel could not persecute Eliyahu on day one? Was because Eliyahu had the same capacity, because he was the continuation of Pinchas. He had the ability to be able to move himself along the spectrum towards more metaphysicality than physicality, which is why she was not able to capture him on the first day. That's parallel number one. Parallel Pinchas and Eliyahu. Let's take this one step further. One more parallel. The cave and Matan Torah. Listen to this fascinating parallel. We saw, this is very similar to Matan Torah in the terms of Moshe Rabbeinu being up on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights without food, right? Now Eliyahu is 40 days and 40 nights traveling after that initial food, 40 days without food and 40 nights without food to get to the Sinai Desert. We hear about Moshe Rabbeinu being caught in the Nikras Hatsur, the cleft of the rock, where he requests to see Hashem, and Hashem passes by, and he sees, so to speak, the back, whatever that means, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Similarly, Eliyahu having this experience of seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu from the Ma'ara, from the cave, seems very, very similar. And finally, when Moshe Rabbeinu comes out, remember, he Koran Or Panov, his face was shining. He had to hide his face, so he had to put the masveh on it. Eliyahu, in a similar way, had the Aderis. The Aderis was to protect him, but it also perhaps was because he himself was shining. What do you do with all of this? How do you put all these pieces together? Here's a fascinating suggestion. I'm doing this based on the theory of the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh and the Malbim. Here's the logical argument they make over here. Eliyahu was a person who lived in the realm of absolute, unequivocal truth. He lived in the realm where if it was precise, it had to be precise. And the closer you get to truth in this world, the less you live in this world. The less you live with the complexities, the darkness, the twistedness, the deception, the corruption, and the multiple layers that exist in this world. Eliyahu and Pinchas could not stand mistruth. And therefore, in the same way, in a certain sense, the blessing for Pinchas standing up for this was the fact that he became less bound to this world. He was less bound to the need to die. That's why he could become invisible, because he wasn't corporeal to the same degree as other human beings, because he was blessed with the Brisi Shalom because of his pursuit of truth, of Kanoi Kinesi Hashem Tzavakos. In a certain sense, it's very similar to the human being who came closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in all of history, who came closest to being able to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that way, and that was Moshe Rabbeinu himself. When he came the closest to the Sharanun, the 50th gateway to becoming close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that Ma'ara, that's where Hashem took Eliyahu back and said, Eliyahu, you're that person. You come the closest to being, we'll call it, as close to the MS of Hashem. But you know what? There's a danger of the MS of Hashem. And that is that people aren't always living up to it. The complexity and the darkness of the mud of real life, Eliyahu, which you've been confronting, isn't always able to deal with that. And you know what, Eliyahu, the way you tried to deal with it, the same way that you dealt with it as Pinchas earlier on, was you cut to the chase. You said, people are misbehaving, cut them down. And you know what? To a certain degree, you're right, as you were when it came to Pinchas the first time around. But in a certain degree, you're also wrong, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because you know what? Lo barash, lo ba'esh, lo baruach. Hashem's not found in all this anger and loudness and strength. Sometimes it's called Dmama Dakat, in a silent, still voice. Sometimes the way to influence the complexity of life is not with truth, but with shalom. And Eliyahu, yes, you live in this world, in this almost metaphysical reality, where you're moving along yourself into the spectrum, into the spiritual, where you're no longer bounded by the spiritual. You can live for 40 days without food. You can become invisible to Izebel. You're living in the space of truth. But you know what? It's dangerous, because that's not the way to influence people. And therefore, Eliyahu, in a certain sense, is being retired over here. In a certain sense, what's really happening to Eliyahu, the Amalbim adds in, that's why the food that he was given was this burning food. It didn't mean that it was just baked on the burning stones. What it actually means is that the food itself was fiery food, because he could consume food of angels, says the Malbim. Fascinating perspective. But that's why he's being retired. What's happening over here at the end is HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying to him, you know what? Hashem is saying to him, you can't be found in all the anger and the fire and the wind and the earthquake, which is what you brought to the nation of Israel. And what does Eliyahu do? He repeats the same statement. Hashem, Kanoi Kinesi. You know what? That's who I am. I can't deviate from truth, says Eliyahu. If I see wrongdoing, I have to say it. If I see misgivings, I have to tell them. And Hashem says, you know what? You're right. I'm going to find somebody else. I'm going to find somebody else who has to talk about his mother and his father, and a person who's going to have to go and share his meat with the rest of the town. He's going to be a person who's going to be much more involved in society, who might be able to deal and live with the complexities of society. That's the Elisha. Go and initiate him. Go and initiate the new leadership of this time. Spread your cloak. Spread the cloak you use at Har Sinai to them. In a certain sense, that's what the Midrash in Shira Shirim Rabbah says actually at the end, that this is the reason why Eliyahu Hanavi comes to visit every bris. Because you questioned, famously, you questioned the bris of Bnei Yisrael. You questioned them keeping the covenant all these years. Well, Hashem says you're going to come back at every bris to see that in the most darkest and difficult of circumstances, they are going to be doing this. Rabbi Riskin talks about when he was in Russia, in the USSR, and he was called in the middle of the night to go witness a bris that was being done in a graveyard because to avoid the KGB arresting them, that's where they had to do the bris. Eliyahu was at that bris as well. Eliyahu comes to every bris to see that we'd never forsake HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even through the complexities and the assimilation and the intermarriage and all the difficulties of history and all the mistakes we've made. Ultimately, we're still clinging on. And that's the question of Eliyahu. The parasha of Eliyahu, says the Al-Sheikh, is the question about how to lead when truth and reality are very far from each other. That's the complexity of this. This is what's being investigated over here. And in a certain sense, Eliyahu ends up being right and Hashem ends up being right. Eliyahu repeats his statement and ultimately becomes a person who actually leaves this world and goes to heaven because that's where he belongs, not in this world. And he has to find an Elisha who can deal with the complex, lying, deceitful people of Israel who perhaps need to have the Kol Demama Daka expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu rather than the Sara, rather than the Eish, rather than the Ruach as well. This is the Eliyahu Hanavi, and this closes our perspective of this incredible journey of this leader. I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the Al-Sheikh in greater detail, the Malbim in greater detail themselves to put the perspectives together. Thank you so much.